FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 10, Episode 8. In this week's episode, we finally got to hear from Jennifer Jeffley. We also heard her backstory from her mother. Give you a little bit more idea of who Jennifer was back then and the circumstances that led her all the way up to the night before the murder and even the morning of the murder. We will probably hit on some. I haven't really talked to Zach yet. He wasn't with us last week, so we haven't really talked a lot about the Eva episode. So I'll see if he has any questions about that, and then we've got a bunch of questions from you guys. We are recording remotely, as it turns out. When they say what happened in Vegas stays in Vegas, that does not include the old Charlie One-Niner, myself and my...
Please don't call it the Charlie One-Niner.
I'm going with Charlie One-Niner, and I'm going to go with hashtag. I think everybody needs to get trending. Hashtag Charlie One-Niner, also known as COVID-19, also known as the Rona. My wife and I came home with the Rona. She is we're okay. She's had it worse than me. She's been really, really tired and has had a headache. I didn't really have any symptoms until the last couple days. I'm really tired and kind of brain foggy. Hopefully that doesn't mean you have a horrible episode on this Sunday, because I still have to write it and I'm having trouble focusing. But we're both okay, but definitely took that with. So no Zach, no Mike in the studio. They are with us, but they are with us via Zoom from their homes. With that being said, let's go ahead and get this show on the road.
Sounds good to me, man.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we get to your questions, I do want to make an announcement that I have officially been invited to CrimeCon. And not only am I going this year, but I'm going to have a special guest attending with me, not Mike this year. Mike has given up his seat for the one and only Zach Weaver, who's going to be going to Austin, Texas with me from June 4th through 6th for this year's CrimeCon 2021.
I feel like you made that too exciting. Like, I'm not that big of a special guest. You're like, we have a special guest. And then everybody's like, oh, it's Zach.
Who is it? Special. Is it Janet Varney? Who is it? No, it's just Zach.
Just Zach.
And I'd also like to note that I didn't give up my seat. I found out I wasn't going when I looked at your Facebook and saw that you posted that Zach was going to go with you.
Now, that's not fair. First of all, let's be clear. You don't like the crime kind of being around all those people. And you told me that you didn't want to go. Now, granted, did I very clearly tell you that you weren't going? No, I just went with the fact that you said you didn't want to, and I asked Zach if he wanted to, because he had expressed interest earlier.
All right, fair enough, man.
That is a tough way to find out, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like finding out your girlfriend broke up with you on Facebook. I have a friend that happened to once. That's a long story. We should have discussed it in the Patreon video section before this. But long story short, we were camping and I looked at Facebook. I'm like, hey, man, I think Tara broke up with you.
What are you guys doing looking at Facebook while you're camping?
We went to the bar. Okay. We were at a bar.
It's against the rules.
Checking our correspondences. But yeah, so Zach and I are going. CrimeCon is June 4th through 6th. It's in Austin, Texas, and they did give me a promo code. I'm looking forward to going. You guys know that in the past I've had some issues with the expenses that are put on to the podcasters in order for us to attend. But then really, maybe it's the fact that we've been kind of locked up for so long and stuff. But I miss my friends. I miss all of you. And I decided I want to go ahead and go and hang out with all my other true crime podcasting buddies and see you guys. So I'm hoping a lot of you show up. We may be doing a true crime binge panel there. They're working right now to see if they can fit in the schedule where for a couple hours each day, I'll have like a live podcasting room where I'll be interviewing other true crime podcasters. So that should be fun, which is what we do on True Crime Binge, by the way, if you haven't listened yet. And they did give us a promo code. So if you want to go, and I hope a lot of you do, the promo code is RUFF, just my last name, and that's going to give you 10% off your tickets. If you go onto the CrimeCon website to get tickets right now, you'll see that what you're doing is joining a wait list. That's because they don't know right now, just yet, exactly how many people will be allowed to be at the venue. So they're having people get on the wait list. They're not going to charge you until unless you have a ticket. And I think they're supposed to, work that all out here very soon. But they're going to go first come, first serve on the wait list. And, so if you get on now, get on early, then as tickets become available, then you'll be one of the first ones to get them. So you just go to CrimeCon's website, crimecon.com, and use promo code RUFF, and and you get on the wait list now. They also have virtual passes if you can't go. I'm not sure what the price is on those. I know they're obviously heavily discounted. But with that promo code, you can get a virtual pass where you can participate from home. And I think you can pick the different sessions and classes and things that you want to watch. So that's a cool way to do it if you don't want to go to Austin or can't go to Austin. So use promo code RUFF to get CrimeCon tickets. Hopefully I'll see a whole bunch of you there. And I think that's the end of housekeeping for now. So before we get into all these questions about this week's episode, Zach, what'd you think about the Eva episode?
See, you're getting me because I was ready to go on this episode.
Okay.
So,
well, let me ask you this. I'm just going to be a very direct question that may backfire on me, I guess. With everything we've heard up to this point, what are your thoughts? Do you have a feeling one way or the other as far as either Jennifer's involvement or Eva's involvement or even Youngster and KD's involvement?
It's hard to say, but I definitely feel like this is going to be a little bland, I think, but I definitely feel like that apartment has some sort of involvement. I don't know who it may be within that apartment, but I feel like somebody that was in that apartment or around that apartment knows more than they're letting on. Whether it's Eva, whether it's Katie, whether it's Youngster, mm-hmm. whether it's Jennifer.
Right.
I feel like there's just too much there to not have something going on.
Well, I mean, I think the wallet in the apartment, which the plan for this week's episode is to go through the medical evidence, but I just don't want to leave everybody hanging. So I think in the first segment, I'm going to break down the story of the wallet and how that came to be. But I think the wallet found in the apartment is obviously, unless that was like planted or something, which it gets pretty far into conspiracy theories, I think the wallet found in the apartment is an obvious indicator someone from that apartment was involved. In my opinion, based on what I've seen from the statements, I think at this point that Eva somehow is involved. I don't think Eva went downstairs and killed her neighbor. I'll say that. But I think that she was definitely involved. And then, so I think it could be Eva and random stranger or strangers that we don't know who they are yet. I think it could be Eva with KD and Youngster, although I don't feel like that's probably what happened at this point, but there's still a lot of work left to do. Or somehow Eva, KD, Youngster, and Jennifer all could be involved. But, these are options that are on the table. But for me personally, I can't see any way how Jennifer's involved. I know there are still plenty of people within our group that think that maybe she was still involved, and that's great because that's what we need people to looking at it from all different perspectives. I just don't see it. She's demonstrated no guilty knowledge of the crime whatsoever in her statements. Her statement fits with elements of the other statements that actually make sense, the parts before they start all veering off and getting mixed up. And there's the fact that the big one for me is just kind of a common sense thing. So if Jennifer was involved with Eva, first of all, I don't see why Eva, I just can't see Eva immediately pointing the finger at her. So if I'm looking at, if the three of us were involved in a crime and the police start questioning us and none of us are suspects, they're just questioning us about what happened. And I say, Zach did it. Zach was involved, and he told me to lie. Zach, then what I'm fully expecting to happen is, since we actually were involved, is as soon as the police start questioning you, for you to be like, no, she did it. Or if they back you into a corner where you end up confessing, that you're also going to turn in the rest of them, especially being 15 years old. I don't think Eva takes that risk. I don't think she takes the risk of implicating someone in the crime who she knows that she was involved in the crime. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know if she participated or not, but I definitely feel like she knows who participated in the murder, whether directly or indirectly.
You're talking about Eva or Jennifer?
Eva.
Yeah, that's where I'm leaning. And, you know, my initial thoughts were it's probably Eva and KD and Youngster. But, man, the more I look at it, I just don't think so. I think kind of my working hypothesis, which, again, is just that. It's just a hypothesis that don't take what I'm saying here as fact at all. But my working hypothesis is that somehow Eva gets mixed up in this thing and she comes back in. I think when, you know, KD hears the door close, you know, hears screaming, hears the door closed. And their door opening or closing, whatever, and then here's it opening again. That's when Youngster gets up. I think Eva's coming back in, and I think she just gathers these three teenagers. I think Youngster's 18, KD is younger, and Jennifer's 15. That she grabs these three and says, "Look, you need." I think she told them all to tell the same lie, that we were all together when we heard this screaming, and there was this voice coming. We all need to say that, or our lives are in danger. And I think that's evident in the fact, and when I said I don't think the screaming happened at all as far as like the fake voice coming, I think what's evident in the fact is all of them, except Eva, because her statements are verifiably false, but the other ones, their statements make sense. They fit together. There's a chronological narrative that goes together until you get to we went downstairs and the screaming happened, and then they're all over the place. Jennifer can't get it right and eventually admits she wasn't there when that happened. But it's also interesting, going back to what we were saying earlier, she doesn't say that didn't happen. She says she wasn't there when that happened, which would seem that either she's very, very clever, or Eva told her that happened and told her to say she was there. And so she thinks that it did happen, but she finally admits, I wasn't there when it happened. KD and Youngster both, I mean, their story, you know, remember everyone was so confused when we did the transparencies episode and we pieced this together. It was like, what the hell? None of this, like they come out and they're all over the place. That you can't lay KD, Youngster, and Eva's statements on top of each other and find an anchor in there where they make sense. The only thing you can find is where they were sleeping. And then with KD and Youngster, how they woke up. So for that reason, some others, I think that Eva got tangled up with someone else. I can't tell you what the motive or how it went down, but someone else went and did it. Eva was involved or at least witnessed that and knows what happened, and then came in order to try to protect herself, tells these three teenagers, tell them that you saw me yelling inside, and that way we're covered. I couldn't have committed the murder if I was outside when it happened, and we're all safe. And then she throws Jennifer under the bus.
Honestly, I really feel for Mrs. Jeffley. Like, after hearing her interview, that's the person that I'm the most touched by at the moment. I mean, you feel absolutely horrible for her. She lost both her sons. She lost her daughter, all within a super pretty short period of time.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I know her daughter, you know, she lost her sons to death and she lost her daughter to prison. But I mean, you're losing children and that's just horrific.
Yeah. I had tears streaming down my face the whole time I was there interviewing her. And it's like I didn't interject a lot. Number one, I just wanted her to be able to get her feelings out. And number two, is like I couldn't, like, what do you even say to someone who's gone through that tragedy? And to be honest with you, Jennifer killed me too during the my interview with her. I don't know if you noticed, but when she starts talking about how she kind of felt alone. And in her mind, nobody was grieving like her, that she was the only one that was really grieving. And she broke down a bit. Like, that got me too pretty bad. But all of them, regardless of Jennifer's involvement in this crime, because let's be clear on this. If Jennifer was involved, and in my opinion, I don't think that she was. But let's say Jennifer was involved. There's still something to be said about the fact that if she was involved, her involvement was a 15-year-old girl getting roped in to be a lookout by two adults for a robbery when this happened. And then the end result is only the 15-year-old girl ends up spending the rest of her life in prison for that. You know, they said the prosecution doesn't even allege that she killed Catalina. They only allege that she was doing exactly what her confession says. So even if she had some involvement, this is still heartbreaking, especially when you hear the circumstances that would lead up to her maybe being in a vulnerable position where she might have got roped into something like that by grownups.
You know, this is maybe a little off topic, but I wonder if she ever has a chance at a Miller case. Because and the reason that comes up is that we've had several around here actually recently, mm-hmm. which is where a juvenile cannot be charged with life in prison and they can resentence them. So I wonder if that's anything they could possibly look into.
I think so. I need to do a little more research on that because actually just yesterday, Maryland just adopted a new law. So the U.S. Supreme Court put this ruling that says that that mandatory life sentences for juveniles should be reevaluated and considered for a new sentencing. And it said somebody from your hometown, mm-hmm. just right around the corner from us here, was just released because of that. But so it just in Maryland yesterday, Rabia Chaudhry just put a post up about that they just passed this bill, which will mean that Adnan Syed will potentially petition now to have his sentence reevaluated. Texas, I don't think, has adopted that yet, but I'm hoping that one way or another that comes in, because there, you know, the case that I mentioned that's local to us here, like, that's a horrific case that this guy got out. And what did he end up serving? 25 years? If that?
I believe so, yeah.
25 years? And this is a guy, so, you know, the short story is he's in high school, I think he was 17, gets his girlfriend pregnant, and then in a very premeditated way, takes his girlfriend out to some country property, kills her, and he either buried the body or burned the body to cover it up. You know, very directly does that, and obviously gets a life sentence for that. And then, due to this new sentencing reform, has a sentence reevaluated, ends up being released. Now, to me, like that, a 17-year-old doing that, I don't know that I'm comfortable saying, well, yeah, but he was only 17, so let's not let him die in prison. Like, I think that was too short of a sentence for him. As opposed to this, where you have a 15-year-old that is just basically present. I mean, essentially her entire case is that she was present when someone else killed someone. Certainly, if this becomes a Miller case that is presented, I think that any judge would look at that and be willing to adjust Jennifer Jeffley's sentence, because even if she's guilty, a life sentence under those circumstances seems extremely harsh, in my opinion. And that's coming from someone who was very victim-centric, where, the case I just mentioned, you know, what bothers me about that is, you know, how is this justice for the victim? This wasn't an accident. This isn't something he got roped into. He planned it and killed her and then concealed the crime scene and the body for a year or two before he was caught. That's very different than the circumstances that we have here.
Well, and the case I was actually thinking about is a case that the two boys that went to high school with your wife, actually, that mm-hmm. they beat one of their mother to death with a shovel. They both just got resentenced under the same thing.
I knew they were up for it. Did they get resentenced?
They both did.
Yeah. So that's another. The one I was just referring to actually happened in Niles, not up in Bridgman. But yeah, that one, again, it's they killed one of their mothers, beat her to death with a shovel while trying to steal a car. And so the point being, without wasting a whole bunch of time digging into these cases, is if these people are getting resentenced based solely on the fact that they were under 18 when they were sentenced, surely someone in Jennifer's situation deserves to have her sentence relooked at, even if she was involved, which I don't think she was.
All right, let's get into these questions, guys. The first one comes from B. B writes, I'll admit it, I got sucked into the ex-wife's page today and was reading all about Jennifer's mental health and how she's a liar and how she was the lookout and Eva and both boys were involved. Not feeling too good about the case right now. Was there other blood on the scene or any DNA evidence that the police found that can be tested against the killer?
Yeah. So the answer to that question is yes. They do have there is DNA, and I believe there's even fingerprints. We're going to get into a forensics episode probably next week or the week after. And none of it was Jennifer's. Have I mentioned yet on the on a follow-up the ex-wife's page?
No, this is the first I've heard of it.
Okay, so let me first explain what she's talking about. So when I first got involved with the case and got involved with the family, they warned me, watch out for this, and I don't remember her name off the top of my head, but watch out for this person. She's got multiple Facebook accounts. Anytime there's any kind of movement in Jennifer's case, she'll jump on and try to spam the page with, you know, trying to convince people Jennifer's guilty. So I just kind of had that in the back of my mind. A month or so goes by. And then a few weeks ago, it happened not in our fan group page, but on the main Truth and Justice page. And someone started, under every single comment or post, started posting links to her Facebook page. And then the Facebook page is like, it's crazy. It's like a model of schizophrenia when you read it. Especially like it just goes all over the place from one position to another. And so I reached out to the family and asked, I'm like, the person you warned me about is here. Who is this person? And they called me to explain it to me. To be honest, I think they were a little embarrassed about the whole situation, why they didn't bring it up prior to this. But so what happened is after Jennifer, I don't know how long she'd been in prison, 15 years, 20 years, this woman starts writing to her and befriends her, and then they end up getting married in prison. So Jennifer married this woman, and then it was very short-lived, and she was an advocate for Jennifer. And then some things happened. I don't want to get into all the dirt, but some things happened that Jennifer was made aware of by other people that this woman was doing to other people and outside of prison. Jennifer decided that this woman was not mentally stable and decided to divorce her. And so then she's working with her family, trying to get this. You know, it's a difficult thing to do from prison. She cuts her off, stops talking to her, and starts the process of divorcing her. When that happens, the woman, this was now the ex-wife, then completely flips and starts, instead of now advocating for Jennifer because she's innocent, starts now trying to convince people that she's guilty. And she's created Facebook pages, and she's put up letters. One of the letters that is posted on her website, like, and this is what I mean, like, it doesn't make sense. It took like 20 reads of it to figure out what was even going on. But she posted a letter trying to indicate how Jennifer is a liar and is guilty by posting a letter that Jennifer had written to, I think it was, I don't know, it was either the local police or maybe even like the apartment manager where she lived or whatever, informing them that there was a circumstance that was going on. You can go try to find, you guys can try to go on and find it, and if you want all the details. But essentially, Jennifer's telling, she's warning someone on the outside about something that this woman is doing. And then the woman then posts that letter as some sort of evidence of Jennifer being unstable or dishonest or guilty or whatever it was. But that's the long and short of it. Anything on that page, I mean, some of the stuff is factual and you can read it, but when you read her opinions on what it means, there's just nothing there. But what you have to understand is she was writing to Jennifer, fell in love with Jennifer, married Jennifer, advocated for Jennifer. When Jennifer cut her off, then she completely flips the script and is now trying to punish Jennifer and keep Jennifer in prison. I've read through, there's nothing on that page that in any way, shape, or form indicated to me that Jennifer even could be guilty. She's not posting evidence of guilt or anything like that. She's just throwing shit against the wall to see what sticks. And it just, the short answer to the question as far as you not feeling good about the case after reading that page is just keep in mind the source. The source is a bitter ex and a bitter ex-wife, and if you see something there that is actual evidence, certainly take that into account. But if you're seeing something where a bitter ex-wife is saying, I think she's guilty, that's not evidence of anything.
All right, Pamela's got a few questions here. Whether or not we find out if Jennifer was or wasn't involved, will you continue to work with her defense and or help coordinate listeners to advocate for her potential release or parole, considering her being a minor at the time of the crime?
Yeah, like I was just saying earlier, even if she was involved, which I want to be very clear, I do not believe she was, but even if she was, a life sentence under these circumstances is unacceptable as far as I'm concerned.
Next, she says, do we know the current status of Jennifer's case? Where it's at in the appeals process? Is your defense working on a specific motion? And do you have a sense of when or if she'll be able to speak about the day of the crime?
Where her case is now is she has a new attorney, good guy. I'm going to mess this up. Sorry, Justin. New York or New Jersey? I want to say New York, but I feel like it might be New Jersey. Who's taken her case pro bono, believes very much in her innocence. And the status is he's still working on investigating right now. There have been no motions filed yet. I think he's doing a really good job of doing his due diligence of gathering as much information and investigating to determine what motion needs to be filed next. But I assume that the next motion would probably be for some sort of testing. I don't know that for sure. He hasn't shared that with me, what he's going to do next. I don't know that he's even decided yet what he's going to do next, but, my estimation would be that there would be a motion for some testing and then very likely a writ of actual innocence based on what we get from the testing or what his and my investigations reveal.
Last, Pamela says, I'm sorry if I'm getting ahead here. There was a crime scene photo on the Crime Watch Daily episode where it looked like Catalina may have been naked from the waist down. Are you able to confirm whether this is the case? Maybe she was just wearing a nightgown. But is there any chance this crime was sexually motivated?
So she's wearing, those are some of the same photos I posted, but I just redact that stuff because I just don't think it's appropriate to post. But yeah, so Catalina is wearing, I don't know if it looks to me like an oversized flannel shirt, but it could be maybe a nightgown, but she's wearing like a flannel shirt and underwear is all she's wearing. As far as whether it's sexually motivated, doesn't seem to be. But again, we're going to be going over the medical evidence in detail this week to find out for sure. But as far as I know, no, there was no sexual motive. But as I'm literally sitting here thinking out loud as I'm saying this, and I wonder if it's worth, I'm going to go back and look at some of those crime scene photos and maybe look at evidence logs. But I would be interested to know now because of the fact that it's a flannel shirt that looks big. If it's a possibility, if it's a men's flannel shirt, I mean, that could change everything. If she had a male friend that was there, I feel like I'm being disrespectful by saying that. I don't mean to be, but it's worth looking into to determine if maybe someone was there, if she had a male friend that was staying there and it was his shirt that she was wearing.
I know you already talked about Jennifer's lawyer, but Gemma has a question regarding Justin. Can you quickly clarify the situation with him? Is he or she listening to Truth and Justice? Does Bob have some kind of relationship, however small and tentative, with him?
Yeah, so I haven't talked to him in 2 or 3 weeks, but yeah, so I don't think I said his name's Justin Bonus. He's the attorney. I've had several conversations with him. And he told me when we did talk that he is listening. He is liking the show. He said he thinks we're doing a really good job. And that was a few weeks ago before we really got into, in my opinion, the evidence that we've uncovered in the last two episodes, not this week, but the 2 weeks before that, when we went over Jennifer's statement and Eva's statements, where we really, I think, hit the nail on the head as far as, one, the potential for Jennifer being innocent, and two, the potential for Eva being involved. And also, I think I need to circle back because I think part of Pamela's question was, do we know or have an idea when Jennifer might be able to talk? I don't know. The last he told me was he didn't want to clear her to do any kind of media interviews until he has the entire case file because he wants to make sure he has a full understanding of the case before he turns her loose to do any kind of interviews. I had my production sent to me before him, so I had been sending over my files directly to him. So he has what I have now on that regard, other than what I just received in the mail yesterday is the remaining crime scene photos that weren't included in the DA's file. I need to go through those, and it's going to take a little while for me to get them to you because they actually sent me a stack of 87 printed 4x6 photos, which was strange. I've never had an open records request delivered that way. Usually it's digital file, but I have printed photos. So I need to go through the ones that we don't have get them scanned in and then get them posted to the website. And then also need to get them over to Justin. So all that'll be coming and hopefully very soon. I'm hoping we'll be able to talk to Jennifer about the case.
Rachel says, I'd like to know how many siblings Jennifer has and their ages and birth order. When did her mom become a single mom?
I'm not sure when she became a single mom. Sounds like for a lot of or most of their childhood. As far as the order of siblings, so that she had four siblings. And gosh, I hope I don't mess this up. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head which was which. But the oldest boy, Thomas, was I think 19 when he died. I don't remember if that was Thomas or Daniel. I apologize to the Jeffleys if they're listening for mixing that up if I'm wrong. But I believe Thomas was 19. And then I think like a year younger than him was Karen. And then the next oldest was, who was 17, was Daniel. And again, I may have Daniel and Thomas mixed up. He's the one who died from cancer, was the middle son. And then there was Kim, who was a year younger than him. And then Jennifer, who was a year and a half younger than Kim. So they were all, it was something when he died, I think Jennifer was like 13 or 14, and then Kim, and then him, and then Karen, and then the oldest son, who I think was Thomas, is the one that was murdered.
Lynn says, since Jennifer cannot comment on her case right now, can you ask her sister or mother for the details of that morning as they believe Jennifer has relayed to them?
Yeah, I mean, I have asked them that, when I was interviewing them, and none of them, you know, the morning of the murder, Jackie, mom, left for work at like 3:30 in the morning. Karen didn't live with them. She had moved out by that point. And Kim was at home and Jennifer wasn't there. Remember, they had run away together, but that night before, Kim had went home, but Jennifer didn't. So none of them have any idea what happened that morning. And they never had a chance to talk to her about it either. Because I asked, did you talk to her? I asked Kim if she talked to her that night when she came back from the police station, if she said anything, and she hadn't. And then the next morning, Kim went to school, and Jennifer didn't the morning that she ended up getting picked up and taken in for questioning.
Kathy says, will you continue to try to find Eva? Can testing still be done on the unknown DNA found?
Hopefully, yes, as far as the DNA. And yes, I'm going to continue to try to find Eva. I would love to talk to her. I'd love to get her side of the story. So I'll be continuing to try to track her down.
Adrian says, this goes back to Eva, but it seems that she at least knows something about what happened and who did it. What do you think the chances are that she would be willing to talk and help Jennifer now if you could track her down? What would the consequences be for her now if, say, she had been associated with the murderer but never plotted to have Catalina killed? Could she be given immunity for her cooperation?
I mean, I can't speak for Eva. I don't know. My hunch is she's probably, and based on other people trying to talk to her in the past, that she likely would not want to talk about the case. If she was, what would happen? I mean, it's a tough situation because if she was involved in the way Jennifer says she was, where she was just there helping, you know, participate in some kind of robbery or something, and then the murder happens, then she could face the same sentence Jennifer has. So obviously that would be a deterrent. If it's, which honestly is what I think is most likely at this point in my mind, that she wasn't involved necessarily, that she, you know, someone she knows committed this and she knows who did it, but didn't want to point the finger at them, then in that case, you'd be dealing with, you know, the issue of perjury, which the statute of limitations has run out on. But still, there's, you know, there could be civil consequences. There's just, it's a very complicated situation, I think, for Eva. And so going to the last part of your question, I think that the only person that could offer that or present that would be a prosecutor as far as immunity. But gosh, I sure would love to have a prosecutor do that. If they tracked her down and offered her immunity to tell them what actually happened, I think that would be the best, most likely way to get her to talk about what actually happened. But no idea if anybody would be willing to do that, or even if she would be willing to talk if they did.
Lisa says, did Jennifer ever confirm the fact that Eva did not know KD or Youngster? I call bullshit that they did not know each other before. Why would they return to Eva's apartment and leave behind their visitor badges from when they were interviewed at the police department?
Yeah, I mean, Jennifer and Eva and I think Katie and Youngster all said they didn't know her. I tend to believe them. As far as the visitor badges, I'm still confused about that, to be honest with you. I don't, that was just like an aside in Alan's report where he says, you know, she says they weren't there. I saw their Polaroid pictures that we took at the police station on the counter. I don't feel like it's standard practice for police to take a photo of someone, they're interviewing them, and then give it to them. I think somebody, it's probably in your next question, which we can probably skip because of this. But I don't see the police saying, well, here's a souvenir for your giving a statement. Here's your picture. So maybe that was like police going up. And I don't know what the deal is with the photos. But as far as them going back, it sounds like I think that's the only place they knew where to find Jennifer. If they were looking for Jennifer, I think she was staying there, obviously, but I think that she was kind of presenting it as like, this is where I live. This is my house. You can imagine a 15-year-old that, is trying to be grown saying, I live with my friend Eva here, even though she had just stayed there for a night. But that was their plan. And I think in Eva's statement, she said that Katie and Youngster came back by looking for Jennifer. And I think she even said Jennifer was there that night. We know from her mom that night. So the first day she goes and gives her first statement. They bring her back that evening, or she goes home that evening, and then she leaves again. Remember in Detective Allen's report, he says that he then went and knocked on the door at Jennifer's apartment after she gave her statement, and Jennifer wasn't there. And he talked to Jackie, and then he went out and he eventually then finds her, and that's when he's having her try to point out Katie and Youngster, who were like in the parking lot, but they slipped away again. So the way I see it going down is when Jennifer gets back, she goes over to Eva's apartment, and Katie and Youngster were there also. They went there trying to find Jennifer, and then they left from there. But I don't think any of that means that Katie and Youngster had to have some relationship with Eva or know who she is or know her in any capacity other than meeting her the night before.
Lynn says, can you explain why Jackie felt the apartment was a nice place, yet Jen calls it the ghetto?
I think it's just perspective. You know what? Jackie is comparing it to the place. She touched on this in her interview, but they had moved into another apartment when they first moved to Houston. And I guess that was a bad neighborhood. You get the implication from her when she says, this place seemed nice. There weren't people outside dealing drugs on the street, and they were, you weren't seeing all this stuff going around based on, their apartment and where they lived. They weren't seeing any of that going on. So the original apartment they lived in ended up burning down, and so they had to move to this place. So from Jackie's perspective, she goes to work at three in the morning. So she goes to bed early in the evenings, gets up, leaves. It seems like a quiet apartment complex. From Jennifer's perspective, she's going to the school. She's out on the streets, hanging out with people, meeting people like Eva and Red Rock and Katie and Youngster. So for her, like, this area compared to where she grew up is the ghetto. And that part of Houston, really, I don't know if I would say ghetto, but it's definitely not a great area, at least back then, for the schools and things like that. So I think it's just perspective. From Jackie's perspective, the apartment complex was nice and quiet. But for Jennifer, who was going to the school and hanging out with the people around there, it was not quite as nice.
Well, I think you hit it on the head right there. I think just saying that, they moved from a rural area to this area in Houston that's not the greatest. So how else are you going to describe it if you don't necessarily know how to describe it? You're immediately going to say, oh, it's ghetto. You're not necessarily meaning it's a ghetto, but that's just a term saying it's a ghetto. People say it about cars. People say that about doors. You know what I mean? Like, you have to do something to it. So,
right.
Kristen says, this question actually pertains to last week's follow-up episode. Not sure if you can answer, but here it goes. Do you have any evidence in the file that Eva was a sex worker, Tommy was a John, and was involved in the crime? I'll admit I was taken aback by your statement about all of that. Thanks.
As far as evidence of Eva being a sex worker, yes. I mean, she has a criminal record that shows that she has been involved with that. Other supporting evidence is the fact that prior to Jennifer being there, she's had many complaints about a bunch of traffic in and out of her apartment. And I think Red Rock going to her apartment to get some sex is another good indicator. And this is all aside from the fact that she has a criminal charge for it. But, you know, he's going to an apartment for a girl he doesn't even know her name to get some sex at 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's a really, really good indicator that she's still participating in the activities at that time that she had been earlier when she had been arrested for it.
I think that could be an indicator of the foot traffic, too, that they had complaints about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. With the traffic going in and out. Yeah. There's because I don't think just somebody just having people in and out is something to be complaining about. But when they just, you know, when there's a steady stream of people and even the mornings make sense. She's a dancer. So she works in the evenings. So if she was doing sex work as a side job, the fact that it would be occurring during the day in the morning makes sense. That would be the time when she would be available to do that. And again, you know, as far as like Red Rock, who's like a known, people in the neighborhood all know him as a crackhead, is the way it's put in some of the statements, to say, I'm going to the Mexican girl in apartment 58 to get some sex. That's not me going to, you know, this girl I've been talking to, or, you know, he doesn't even know what her name is. As far as Tommy being a John or being involved, that's just 100% just a speculative hypothesis. And if I didn't make that clear, I want to make sure I'm making that clear. I'm just trying to put pieces of a puzzle together the way he's described. She gets a page from a guy she knows from work. She doesn't know his last name. And her only explanation for him texting her is that, oh, he just likes to bother me. Maybe he's just a guy that likes to text her. I said page her. Maybe he's just a guy that likes to page somebody to bother them. But it's not like text messaging or calling. I mean, how bothersome is it just to have a number come across? I think it's reasonable to hypothesize that he may be a John. I'm not saying that he is, but I think it's reasonable to hypothesize that. And as far as him being involved, I don't know if this guy's involved. But what I'm looking at is, where's the trigger? What changed? What, you know, I don't believe Eva woke up at 9 o'clock in the morning and said, you know what, it's morning, I'm going to have a cup of coffee and go kill my neighbor, or even go rob my neighbor at that time. I don't think, you know, all the way back to the first episode, I think Catalina was a victim of opportunity. She had no victimology indicating that anybody would target her for this. So I'm looking at it like something happened. Someone was added to this mix that wasn't already there that causes to happen. And when I see that the person who the wallet is found in her apartment, and I see that somebody's reaching out to her just, you know, an hour before it happens, I think that person, I'd put it a couple episodes ago, that if I was a detective, I want to find Tommy. I need to talk to Tommy. This is a person that's reaching out to you, and it happens right below you. I want to know who this person is.
I wonder if it's more, not necessarily Tommy, but the person involved could be more of her pimp or a male madam, whatever you prefer.
Uh-huh.
But because I feel like the person has control over her more than a John would. If it was just a John, you know, obviously maybe she's embarrassed by the sex work, but I still feel like you would eventually turn them in for murder over being a John. You know what I mean? Or if it's a pimp, something like that, they have more control over her. So would be a better reason to hide them.
You know, a lot of people suggested that, and I'm not ruling it out that there was like some kind of controlling relationship there. But I don't know that I've been doing, which is a weird thing to research, my browser history at this point. But, you know, there are a lot of independent sex workers, especially in that industry, that wouldn't even have, I'm trying to find the most PC term.
You could try boss.
Boss. There you go. But whatever you want to call somebody like that, that is controlling and funneling people to her. If and again, this is all just hypothesizing, but I guess what I'm saying is there didn't necessarily have to be that boss figure in that relationship. It also doesn't seem likely that if that was the case, that she would have ignored the text. And it seems like she ignored the text because she didn't have a phone. You know, maybe she left and went and used a phone somewhere, but we don't have evidence to support that. Nobody saw her anywhere, at least anybody that was talked to. So it seemed to me that whoever texted her, maybe, or paged her, the way it was working out in my mind is that they paged her trying to, you know, set something up to come visit her. When she didn't answer, they just went to the apartment, which seems like it's not that strange of a thing to happen, considering that's exactly what Red Rock was doing. He was just going to go pop into the apartment to see if he could, quote, get some sex.
All right, that's all we got for questions.
All right, thanks, guys. Hopefully quarantine will be over by next week and we'll be able to be in the studio together. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to tune in this weekend. The plan is to cover the story about the wallet and get into the medical evidence. Make sure you tune in for that. Also, this week's episode of True Crime Binge features Catherine Townsend, who is a very talented investigative journalist. She's also a private investigator and true crime podcaster. And she has a new podcast called Red Collar, where she investigates white collar criminals who turn violent. We discuss a really interesting case of an axe murder in this week's episode, a white collar axe murder, or red collar crime, as she calls it. So make sure you check out that episode of True Crime Binge. Again, thank you all for listening, and hopefully a bunch of you will jump on CrimeCon's website and get some tickets so we can see you all there. Remember to use my promo code RUFF. Mike, Zach, thanks for Zooming, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd really like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, Truth and Justice Pod. Just click the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING, and Zach is at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.